Chapter 39. Solemn and impressive at any time, and the very dissimilarity of this one from any we have been accustomed to, only enhances the impression. The meanness of its appointments, the bare and scanty pulpit, with the paltry painted pillars on either side, the women's gallery with its great heavy curtain, the men's with its unpainted benches, and dingy front, the tottering little table at the altar, with the commandments on the wall above it, scarcely legible through lack of paint, and dust and damp, so unlike the velvet and gilding, the marble and wood, of a modern church, are strange and striking. There is one object, too, which rivets the attention and fascinates the gaze, and from which we may turn horror-stricken in vain, for the recollection of it will haunt us, waking and sleeping, for a long time afterwards. Immediately below the reading desk, on the floor of the chapel, and forming the most conspicuous object in its little area, is the condemned pew. A huge black pen, in which the wretched people, who are singled out for death, are placed on the Sunday preceding their execution, in sight of all their fellow prisoners, from many of whom they may have been separated, but a week before, to hear prayers for their own souls, to join in the responses of their own burial service, and to listen to an address, warning their recent companions, to take example by their fate, and urging themselves, while there is yet time nearly 24 hours to turn, and flee from the wrath to come. Imagine what have been the feelings of the men whom that fearful pew has enclosed, and of whom, between the gallows and the knife, no mortal remnant may now remain. Think of the hopeless clinging to life to the last, and the wild despair, far exceeding in anguish the felon's death itself, by which they have heard the certainty of their speedy transmission to another world, with all their crimes upon their heads, rung into their ears by the officiating clergyman. At one time, and at no distant period either, the coffins of the men about to be executed were placed in that pew, upon the seat by their side, during the whole service. It may seem incredible, but it is true. Let us hope that the increased spirit of civilization and humanity which abolished this frightful and degrading custom may extend itself to other usages equally barbarous, usages which have not even the plea of utility in their defense, as every year's experience has shown them to be more and more inefficacious. Leaving the chapel, descending to the passage so frequently alluded to, and crossing the yard before noticed as being allotted to prisoners of a more respectable description than the generality of men confined here, the visitor arrives at a thick iron gate of great size and strength. Having been admitted through it by the turnkey on duty, he turns sharp round to the left, and pauses before another gate. And, having passed this last barrier, he stands in the most terrible part of this gloomy building, the condemned ward. The press yard, well known by name to newspaper readers, from its frequent mention in accounts of executions, is at the corner of the building, and next to the ordinary's house, in Newgate Street. Running from Newgate Street, towards the center of the prison, parallel with Newgate Market, it is a long, narrow court, of which a portion of the wall in Newgate Street forms one end, and the gate the other. At the upper end, on the left hand that is, adjoining the wall in Newgate Street is a cistern of water, and at the bottom a double grating of which the gate itself forms a part, similar to that before described. Through these grates the prisoners are allowed to see their friends, a turnkey always remaining in the vacant space between, during the whole interview. Immediately on the right as you enter, is a building containing the press room, day room, and cells. The yard is on every side surrounded by lofty walls guarded by chevaux de frise, and the whole is under the constant inspection of vigilant and experienced turnkeys. In the first apartment into which we were conducted, which was at the top of a staircase, and immediately over the press room were 25 or 30 prisoners, all under sentence of death, awaiting the result of the recorder's report, men of all ages and appearances, from a hardened old offender with swarthy face, and grizzly beard of 3 days' growth, to a handsome boy, not 14 years old, and of singularly youthful appearance even for that age, who had been condemned for burglary. There was nothing remarkable in the appearance of these prisoners. One or two decently dressed men were brooding with a dejected air over the fire. Several little groups of two or three had been engaged in conversation at the upper end of the room, or in the windows, and the remainder were crowded round a young man seated at a table, who appeared to be engaged in teaching the younger ones to write. The room was large, airy, and clean. There was very little anxiety or mental suffering depicted in the countenance of any of the men. They had all been sentenced to death, it is true, and the recorder's report had not yet been made. But, we question whether there was a man among them, notwithstanding, who did not know that, although he had undergone the ceremony, it never was intended that his life should be sacrificed. On the table lay a testament, but there were no tokens of its having been in recent use. In the press room below, were three men, the nature of whose offense rendered it necessary to separate them, even from their companions in guilt. It is a long, somber room, with two windows sunk into the stone wall, and here the wretched men are pinioned on the morning of their execution, before moving towards the scaffold. The fate of one of these prisoners was uncertain. Some mitigatory circumstances having come to light since his trial, which had been humanely represented in the proper quarter. The other two had nothing to expect from the mercy of the crown. Their doom was sealed. No plea could be urged in extenuation of their crime, and they well knew that for them there was no hope in this world. The two short ones, apostrophe the turnkey whispered, were dead men. Apostrophe, the man to whom we have alluded as entertaining some hopes of escape, was lounging, at the greatest distance he could place between himself and his companions, in the window nearest to the door. He was probably aware of our approach, and had assumed an air of courageous indifference. His face was purposely averted towards the window, and he stirred not an inch, while we were present. The other two men were at the upper end of the room. One of them, who was imperfectly seen in the dim light, had his back towards us, and was stooping over the fire, with his right arm on the mantelpiece, and his head sunk upon it. The other was leaning on the sill of the farthest window. The light fell full upon him, and communicated to his pale, haggard face, and disordered hair, an appearance which, at that distance, was ghastly. His cheek rested upon his hand, and, with his face a little raised, and his eyes wildly staring before him, he seemed to be unconsciously intent on counting the chinks in the opposite wall. We passed this room again afterwards. The first man was pacing up and down the court with a firm military step. He had been a soldier in the foot guards, and a cloth cap jauntily thrown on one side of his head. He bowed respectfully to our conductor, and the salute was returned. The other two still remained in the positions we have described, and were as motionless as statues. Three, a few paces up the yard, and forming a continuation of the building, in which are the two rooms we have just quitted, lie the condemned cells. The entrance is by a narrow and obscure staircase leading to a dark passage, in which a charcoal stove casts a lurid tint over the objects in its immediate vicinity, and diffuses something like warmth around. From the left-hand side of this passage, the massive door of every cell on the story opens, and from it alone can they be approached. There are three of these passages, and three of these ranges of cells, one above the other. But in size, furniture and appearance, they are all precisely alike. Prior to the recorder's report being made, all the prisoners under sentence of death are removed from the day room at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and locked up in these cells, where they are allowed a candle until 10 o'clock, and here they remain until 7 next morning. When the warrant for a prisoner's execution arrives, he is removed to the cells, and confined in one of them until he leaves it for the scaffold. He is at liberty to walk in the yard, but, both in his walks and in his cell, he is constantly attended by a turnkey who never leaves him on any pretense. We entered the first cell. It was a stone dungeon, 8 feet long by 6 wide, with a bench at the upper end, under which were a common rug, a Bible, and prayer book. An iron candlestick was fixed into the wall at the side, and a small high window in the back admitted as much air and light as could struggle in between a double row of heavy, crossed iron bars. It contained no other furniture of any description. Conceive the situation of a man, spending his last night on earth in his cell. Buoyed up with some vague and undefined hope of reprieve, he knew not why, indulging in some wild and visionary idea of escaping, he knew not how hour after hour of the 3 preceding days allowed him for preparation, has fled with a speed which no man living would deem possible, for none but this dying man can know. He has wearied his friends with entreaties, exhausted the attendants with importunities, neglected in his feverish restlessness the timely warnings of his spiritual consoler, and, now that the illusion is at last dispelled, now that eternity is before him and guilt behind, now that his fears of death amount almost to madness, and an overwhelming sense of his helpless, hopeless state rushes upon him, he is lost and stupefied, and has neither thoughts to turn to, nor power to call upon, the Almighty Being, from whom alone he can seek mercy and forgiveness, and before whom his repentance can alone avail. Hours have glided by, and still he sits upon the same stone bench with folded arms, heedless alike of the fast decreasing time before him, and the urgent entreaties of the good man at his side. The feeble light is wasting gradually, and the death-like stillness of the street without, broken only by the rumbling of some passing vehicle which echoes mournfully through the empty yards, warns him that the night is waning fast away. The deep bell of St. Paul's strikes one. He heard it. It has roused him. 7 hours left. He paces the narrow limits of his cell with rapid strides, cold drops of terror starting on his forehead, and every muscle of his frame quivering with agony. 7 hours. He suffers himself to be led to his seat, mechanically takes the Bible which is placed in his hand, and tries to read and listen. No. His thoughts will wander. The book is torn and soiled by use, and like the book he read his lessons in, at school, just 40 years ago. He has never bestowed a thought upon it, perhaps, since he left it as a child. And yet the place, the time, the room, nay, the very boys he played with, crowd as vividly before him, as if they were scenes of yesterday. And some forgotten phrase, some childish word, rings in his ears like the echo of one uttered, but a minute since. The voice of the clergyman recalls him to himself. He is reading from the sacred book its solemn promises of pardon for repentance, and its awful denunciation of obdurate men. He falls upon his knees and clasps his hands to pray. Hush! What sound was that? He starts upon his feet. It cannot be 2 yet. Hark! 2 quarters have struck, the 3rd, the 4th. It is. 6 hours left. Tell him not of repentance. 6 hours repentance for 8 times 6 years of guilt and sin. He buries his face in his hands, and throws himself on the bench. Worn with watching and excitement, he sleeps, and the same unsettled state of mind pursues him in his dreams. An insupportable load is taken from his breast. He is walking with his wife in a pleasant field, with the bright sky above them, and a fresh and boundless prospect on every side, how different from the stone walls of Newgate. She is looking not as she did when he saw her for the last time in that dreadful place, but as she used when he loved her long, long ago, before misery and ill-treatment had altered her looks, and vice had changed his nature, and she is leaning upon his arm, and looking up into his face with tenderness and affection, and he does not strike her now, nor rudely shake her from him. And oh! How glad he is to tell her all he had forgotten in that last hurried interview, and to fall on his knees before her, and fervently beseech her pardon for all the unkindness and cruelty that wasted her form, and broke her heart. The scene suddenly changes. He is on his trial again. There are the judge and jury, and prosecutors, and witnesses, just as they were before. How full the court is what a sea of heads with a gallows too, and a scaffold, and how all those people stare at him. Verdict, guilty. Apostrophe no matter, he will escape. The night is dark and cold, the gates have been left open, and in an instant he is in the street, flying from the scene of his imprisonment like a wind. The streets are cleared, the open fields are gained, and the broad, wide country lies before him. Onward he dashes in the midst of darkness, over hedge and ditch, through mud and pool, bounding from spot to spot with a speed and lightness, astonishing even to himself. At length he pauses. He must be safe from pursuit now. He will stretch himself on that bank and sleep till sunrise. A period of unconsciousness succeeds. He wakes, cold and wretched. The dull, gray light of morning is stealing into the cell, and falls upon the form of the attendant turnkey. Confused by his dreams, he starts from his uneasy bed in momentary uncertainty. It is but momentary. Every object in the narrow cell is too frightfully real to admit of doubt or mistake. He is the condemned felon again, guilty and despairing, and in 2 hours more will be dead. Characters. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.